Can I just say, if somebody, a lady who was talking to me last night, left a packet of tissues on the table, and she asked me for my address. So if she come, they're here. My name is Khan, and I'm an alcoholic. I have to stand because I'm small, and I won't be able to see you at the back. Before I go any further, I do want to say a word of my own tribute to those of you who are in Al-Anon and Alateen. As an alcoholic, I tried to disguise my drinking, and I hid my alcohol. And I didn't hide it in the obvious places, like in the wardrobe or behind the toilet system. I used some ingenuity so that when I went for it, it would be there. It stayed put. And sure enough, it was. You see, but you people in Al-Anon, and at least some of you who were in Alateen, you didn't have to hide alcohol, you had to hide the alcoholic. And we didn't stay put where you put us. We came out, and especially when you had visitors. So we have caused you trouble and suffering. And that's just one example of it. And I admire you for, despite the suffering we've caused you, I admire you, Al-Anon, Alateen, Families Anonymous, and other similar groups, for the support you give us. And I want to say God bless you for it, because our life wouldn't be the same without you. So, having said that, my name is Khan, and I'm an alcoholic. It took me a long time to admit that, but you see, I find this talk on spirituality and spiritual awakening, I don't feel competent to speak here in the abstract and generalities about spirituality. I prefer to tell you my own experience of how I had to learn what spirituality is. I had to learn the difference between spirituality and religion. I had to learn what a spiritual awakening is. I had to learn it, and I had to learn it very painfully. And I only feel competent to give you my own experience of that. I'm speaking for myself. And if you can identify with it, then I'm pleased. But I only feel comfort. So I have to tell you something of my own story. And as I say, at first, for a while, I couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic for several reasons. One is because it played no part in my upbringing. I am the second eldest of seven children, with six boys and one girl, and neither of my parents drank, and nobody in my family drinks. My brothers don't drink, my sister doesn't drink, I'm the only one who drank. In fact, I've traced my family back to my great-grandparents on both sides, and in every direction, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, I can't find anyone who's got any kind of addictive problem except me. I'm just there alone, the only addicted person in the entire clan, you see. And so you can understand it was difficult for me to recognize my alcoholism. The other thing is, what was very much a part of our family life, both in Ireland, where I come from, and in England when we moved over there, was a very strong Catholic faith and involvement in the Catholic Church, the local Catholic Church. My parents were very active church workers, and all we were, my brothers, my sister, and it wasn't that something forced down our throats. We loved it, we enjoyed it, you see. And so at 17, I felt called to be a priest, and I left home at 17 to start preparing for the priesthood. Let me just tell you in an aside, I actually had a girlfriend at 17, and we'd been going together since we were 15, and I now had to tell her that I felt called to be a priest. I put off telling her until my mother said, "You've got to tell her." And so I told her. I said, "I've got to let you know, I'm going away in September. I think I'm called to be a priest." And she said, "Thank God." And of course, And she said, "I've been trying to tell you for months that I'm going away in August to be a nun." And all the other kids thought it was a mutual suicide pact. So anyway, I leave home at 17, and at 24 I'm ordained a priest. And all that time I'd never tasted alcohol. 24. And then I did postgraduate studies in Rome and so on. And really, I didn't taste alcohol outside the Eucharist. I didn't taste alcohol until I was 28 or 29. And it was innocent social drinking. At least that's what it looked like, and that's what I always thought it was. And I used to wonder, when did I start drinking alcoholically? When was it abnormal? And I was some time in recovery before I realized that what my early drinking looked like wasn't that way at all. I'll tell you what the form, it took two forms. On a Sunday evening, after all the services and that were over, myself and the other priest that I was living with, we were relaxed with a couple of glasses of whiskey, shots of whiskey, no more than two. And then the other way was friends would invite me out for a meal, and I would have with them a drink before the meal and maybe a glass of wine during it. Now that was innocent social drinking, that's what it seemed to me. But I now know there was not. There was several abnormal things about it. Oh, incidentally, I've done a copy of what I want to say to you, not my own personal sub-story, but what I want to say to you, so you're welcome to take these afterwards. First of all, the one abnormal thing was I was preoccupied with the alcohol from the beginning. All day Sunday I would have been thinking we'd be having a drink. And if I went out with friends, I would be thinking, oh, we're going to have a drink. And so I realized that my friends were having a drink with the meal, but I was having a meal with a drink. See? And it's this preoccupation subtly, gradually grew to become the obsession and the craving that eventually showed itself. I didn't see it way back then, but it was there, the abnormality. You see? Another thing that was abnormal was that I could drink an awful lot. And I thought that was very macho. You see? And I never had a hangover in all my drinking. I never had a hangover. And I thought, that was great. But of course it wasn't. My body was betraying me, because our bodies, haven't they? They've got a safety factor that if we take too much of any drug, we go unconscious. But I didn't. And so I went on and on. The worst thing of all was the blackouts from the beginning. I didn't know there were blackouts. I'd never heard of blackouts like him into recovery. That seems to be true of most of us. But I do know that on a Sunday evening, after two whiskies, I wouldn't remember going to bed. And if I was had a gin and tonic and a couple of glasses of wine at a meal with friends in a restaurant, I would have no memory of any conversation or even what I'd had for the meal. And I presume that's what happened when you had a drink. I never checked with anybody else. I never said to the other priest, do you not remember going to bed or anything? I thought that was the normal thing. But I now know that was not. That was abnormal. And it was very gradual, very slow. And it got me into the most awful trouble later on. And terribly embarrassing situations, these blackouts. I was invited quite often to preach on special occasions in different parts of the world. And I remember I was asked, the first time I was asked to preach in the presence of a bishop, and by that time I was really drinking all day. And I came to my senses in a hall like this, where people were having a buffet and a bishop was talking to me. And I said to myself, where am I and who is this bishop? And I remembered that I was supposed to preach in the presence of a bishop. And if they're having a buffet, I must have already done so. What kind of a fool have I made of myself? And it's only when I was doing my first step in unmanageability, I was advised to write to people who were there and find out what kind of a fool I'd made of myself. And I did, and they wrote back and said, you preached a great sermon. Unconscious. There was worse. It was a community of nuns asked me to preach for a whole week to them, a retreat. And by this time, I was drinking all day, and I was with so-called friends, drinking companions, or they were to drop me off at the convent. I woke up in bed and looked around, and there was pictures and statues, and I realized I was obviously in the guest bedroom of a convent. And I have no memory of getting there. So I thought, I better get out. So I hurriedly dressed, got my things together, opened the door, and there was a nun. And she said, your breakfast is in here, Father. So she took me in. There was some grapefruit. And she said, we are looking forward to the week. That was a beautiful sermon you gave last night. And I have no memory of even being there. And I cringed to think what might have happened. Suppose I'd wandered about. Suppose I'd wandered up towards the nuns' bedrooms. Where would I have ended up? And I don't think I could be mistaken for a hot water bottle. Will there be somebody come out of my blackouted past and a blacked out past and say, Daddy? And Mama's a mother superior. And listen what I said to myself. I did not say I better stop the drinking. I said I better not take on these preaching engagements. The drinking was interfering, the preaching was interfering with my drinking. And that's how I started to cut corners. And that's where the guilt and the shame came in. Because we priests and ministers, we have to, as pastors, we visit people according to their need. We visit the sick and the housebound. We visit the elderly. We visit those who are bereaved and grieving. And we visit families, people trying to bring up their children in a difficult world, to encourage them and to become friends and friends with the children. And I was doing that. And doing it well. At the end of my drinking, I was the parish priest of one of the biggest parishes in Britain, and I was the leader of a team of 23 priests. So I was fooling some of the people all of the time. I was getting drunk every day. So I began to visit people not according to their need of me, but of my need of a drink. So I didn't visit the sick and the grieving and families. I visited people not who would give me a drink. What use is a drink to an alcoholic? I would visit people who drank like me. And I became so ashamed and felt so guilty. And I can never make amends for that, because I wasn't there for people when they needed me. And I can never make amends for that. And I couldn't take that shame and that guilt. And so I had to drink more. And it went a downward spiral. You see? And I felt I was a bad priest. And a bad person. And so I asked for help. And I went into a clinic, a treatment centre. Not the Castle Craig, the treatment centre in Scotland, where the clinic in Scotland where I work as pastoral counsellor, I have other ministries as well, but that is a ministry of mine in Scotland. This was in England. And I would like to say I lived happily ever after, but in actual fact, in another way, my troubles were just starting. I just could not get the programme. And I didn't want their programme, I wanted my programme. The average stay in the clinic that I was in was 2 months, and I was there for 7 months. I hold the record. And I'd have thrown me out, but they kept me. And I'm so grateful to them, because they literally saved my life. And the first thing was, I couldn't move. I was paralyzed with the shame and the guilt. And I couldn't accept that I had an illness. To me, this was a dodge. The shame and the guilt. I was trapped in this shame and guilt. I didn't deserve to recover. I deserved to be punished. I could not forgive myself. And this came to a head, and I was given the key to be released from the shame and the guilt. A spiritual key. And I'll share it with you. But first of all, there was this particular therapist who would not let me away with anything, thank God, but I hated him. And every Friday he used to turn and he'd say to me in front of everyone, "You're the sickest person here." That was my weekend ruined, you see. And I used to watch him driving away on a Friday evening, and I wished, and in fact I sometimes prayed, that he'd have an accident. Not that he'd be killed, just maimed would do, so long as he didn't come back. But on Sunday night, thank God, he came back. And in actual fact, I ended up eventually, after 6 months, asking him to hear my fifth step. Just shows the progress I made, or he made, or between. But one Monday, he said to me in group, "Have you got £20 to spend?" I said, "Yeah, just about." But he said, "I want you this week to think of someone whom you really love and care for, and on Friday, tell us who it is, and you're going to spend that £20 on them this weekend." And I thought, I don't know what this has got to do with recovery, because that's what he wants me to do. I had no difficulty. I have a big family and so on. And so I was all ready on the Friday to tell him. And when I began, he said, no, wait a minute. He said, don't spend the £20 on somebody else. Spend it, the £20 on yourself. And tell us on Monday what you bought yourself. I couldn't do it. I couldn't spend the £20. And in the group on Monday, when he said, how, I said, I couldn't do it. He said, why not? I said, it would be a waste of money. So he said to the group, what does that tell you about Khan? And they said, you hate yourself. Somebody said, you don't even value yourself as worth £20. And somebody else said, the commandment of love is you must love your neighbor as you love yourself. How can you love anybody? You hate yourself. And I said, well, what do I do? How do I do it? How do I forgive myself? And somebody said, you don't think yourself into forgiving it. You have to behave that way. And this patient gave me the key. He said, have you got young brothers? I said, I've got four of them. Well, he said, suppose it was one of your young brothers who had done all the things that you are hating yourself for. Would you hate him? Would you refuse to forgive him? Would you stop talking to him? And I said, no, I wouldn't. Well, he said, why don't you see the sick side of you as the young brother side of you? He said, I don't mean your split personality, but there's the healthy side of you that you've lost sight of, but people tell you when you're not drinking you're a good person and a good priest, but you've lost sight of that. But there's the young brother side of you who is impulsive, immature, irresponsible and spoilt rotten, and that's the sick part of you. And but you love him, but you're not going to let him have his own way anymore. And I have found that over the years of my sobriety very, very helpful. And in Castle Craig Clinic, where I work, I've suggested it to other people. For women patients, I suggest they might prefer to say young sister side of you. And they've told me that this, they have found, like I did, they've found this, the answer for them. And it was for me. I don't claim to have any original ideas. I want to tell people, tell you, tell patients what was done for me, how I was taught through this, you see. And this young brother, and that's where it says in the big book of AA, remember we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling and powerful. Well, for me, alcohol is just an inert chemical. How could it be cunning? But this young brother side of me is cunning and baffling and powerful because he wants to drink again. And I have to say, no, you won't. You're not having your own way anymore. And he's still active. He's still there. Now, I'm going deaf, you see. And I find it difficult to hear what people are saying in meetings. And you feel a bit of a fool because somebody has said something funny and everybody laughs and I haven't heard it. You see? And so my sick side of me, my young brother's side, said it's pointless going to meetings, you're getting deaf. But the healthy side of me said I can go to small meetings. See how he wants to go back drinking, this side of me. And if I stop going to meetings, I will go back drinking. You see? So I was now set free. It took a while, but I was on my way. And then I ran into the next difficulty, you see. I'm a good practicing Catholic. So therefore, I don't need AA. I've got my religion. You see? First of all, if God's going to let me have this blasted disease, it's up to God to cure me, and he must do it through religion. I would have preferred leprosy. You see, but he's given me this shameful disease because I wasn't yet free of the shame. I was beginning to be free. So I've got this disease. So why can't God give me the cure or recovery through communion, through Bible study, through prayer groups? Why have to go mix with all these drunks? You see? And I was so angry with God. First of all, in letting me have this disease, it was no consolation to me to know I had a disease, really. And why doesn't he give me recovery through my church, through my religion? I was so angry. I remember somebody said to me, your face is like a red traffic light with anger. Stop. And I snarled, I'm not angry. I said, I'm taking after my mother. She has a high complexion. And they just said, well, what was she angry about? So, one thing you learn in clinics, you can't win. They know all more than you do. They know all about it, you see. I was hiding things I couldn't. Everybody knew. They could see me, read me like a book. Everybody could. I thought I was getting away with it. And I had to learn. And And this was a hard lesson to learn, that there is no evidence at all, I was told, and I checked on it, there is no evidence at all that anybody ever got stable sobriety through religious belief or practice. Some people in the first flush of a born-again conversion can abstain from alcohol or other drugs. But as soon as they get used to their religion, a practice, they relapse. They don't keep it up. It's so rare that I've been told it is statistically zero. It's so rare. Now what is God playing at? I now believe, and I know, that God gives me sobriety through the program of the 12 steps. I believe, firmly believe, that is just as much from God as the Bible is, and the Eucharist is. That's the way God has chosen. People getting stable sobriety through a religious practice is statistically zero. In the last 66, 70 years, millions of people have got sobriety through the 12 steps, and are today, me, you, all of us. And so I was told, that's the way God works. And you don't tell God how to give you the gift of sobriety. God's going to do it in his way. So I had to see, I said, then what is spirituality? And this is what I had to learn, the difference. You see, I learned that every human being who is able to think, born able to think and feel, we don't think and feel in a vacuum. We think about something or about someone, or we feel about something or about someone. And I came to realize, we do this in three directions. It's how I feel about myself, how I think about myself, my attitude to myself, my relationship with myself. How I feel and think about other people, my attitude to other people, and how I think and feel about some idea of God, however I visualize God. And those wonderful people, the ancient Greeks, they had two words to sum us up. They said we're made up of two things, the soma and the psyche. And the soma is everything about my body, all its needs and functions. And the psyche is my thinking and my feeling and my thinking about myself, my thinking about other people, and my thinking about God. And this psychic part of me is what I understand by natural human spirituality. That's what, to me, is spirituality. What is religion, then? Religion is not to do with the individual. None of us is born with a religion. Religion is a belief and practice of a community of people. It may be a very local community, it may eventually be a worldwide community. And I was born into a family that is a member of a religious community. I wasn't born with a religion. I was born into a family that is a member of a worldwide religious community. And then they initiated me into this religion. You see, whatever the religion is, in my case it was baptism. And then, as I'm being brought up, I either make my own the religious belief and practice of my family and this community, or I reject it. And some people are born into families who are not members of a religious community, and maybe later on in life they become members of a religious community themselves. Others are born into a family in one religious community, and they change to another. And there are millions of us who are in families that belong to religious communities, millions of us. But every human being has a spirituality, because every human being who is able to think and feel thinks about themselves, feels about themselves, feels about other people, and feels something about God. And that's what we mean by spirituality, you see. So religion is not the same thing. And Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and the other fellowships say we are not talking about religion when we say that you have a spiritual illness. We're not saying there's something wrong with your religious practice or belief. They say there may be something wrong with your religious practice and belief, but that's not the cause of your addiction. It's the result of your addiction. Because your human spirituality is sick, therefore it may well be your religious practice will fail. And the answer, a spiritual recovery, is not to have a better religion or to try better at religion. The answer is to have positive, healthy attitude to yourself, positive, healthy attitude to other people, and positive, healthy attitude to God. And that's a spiritual recovery. Now, I have found my religious belief and practice enriches my spiritual recovery of the 12 steps. And the 12 steps, in fact, enriches my religious belief and practice. But I must be very careful that I know where my sobriety comes from. Well-meaning people say to me, now that you're so many a long time in recovery, or cured, they say, and I say I'm not cured, of course, and they say, you don't have to keep going to AA, do you? You know, why don't you join another Bible study? I said, no, that's where my recovery is from AA, and always will be, you see. What has been a help to me, in fact, is I have another illness. I am an insulin-dependent diabetic. And whether I like it or not, this morning I had to inject myself with insulin, and I shall have to do so again this evening. And it doesn't matter a hoot whether I feel like it or not. If I want to live a reasonably normal life, that's my medicine. And this helped me and does help me because I came to realize I discovered that I was a diabetic because I tried to eat like ordinary people and I got ill. I didn't choose to be a diabetic, and I realized I didn't choose to be an alcoholic. I tried to drink like ordinary people and I got ill. And just as I need my insulin to live a normal life, that's my medicine, I need the AA program and the AA fellowship. And it doesn't matter a hoot whether I feel like it or not. If I want to live sane and sober, I need AA. You see? Whether I like it or not. In fact, I do like it, even if I'm going through a phase at the moment, actually, that's why I'm grateful for this conference and convention. I'm going through a phase at the moment, which I've been through before, where I hate going to AA. I'm bored out of my mind at meetings, because they won't do them my way. And, you know, I had a marvelous sponsor when I came out of treatment. They told me, for God's sake, don't you get a devout practicing Catholic man. Get an atheist if you can, but don't get it. He'd be going, yes, Father, no, Father, three bags full, Father, you see. And I had a marvelous sponsor. He was very good for me because when I came out of treatment, it's too strong to say I was recovering. I'd given myself such a hard time in that 7 months. I was very fragile, emotionally fragile. The strongest I was convalescent. And he was marvelous. He coped with my tantrums and he answered my questions. And I was living down in the west of England at that time, and it's all villages there. I was all village meetings, small meetings, where it was the same people every week. And there was a woman at this meeting that I am a sponsor with. Every week she had some sad story about her dog. And she would cry, the dog was off its food, or the dog was sneezing, or the dog had diarrhea, or the dog had this, that, and the other. And I came out of a meeting and I said, if that woman mentions her bloody dog another time. And my sponsor said, oh, I see. People have to meet your standards, do they, before they can share? They can only share intellectual things. He said, that woman is worried about her dog, and she'll drink on it if she can't share. He said, how dare you decide what somebody else will share? He said, don't you realize what we're doing? At an AA meeting and an NA meeting, we're allowed to eavesdrop on somebody else's troubles. Isn't this a privilege? And we're sometimes allowed to eavesdrop on how good they've been. And so they can share what they like. You don't have to approve of it. You're allowed to eavesdrop. I still find some shares boring, but I've learned to keep a mouth shut about that. Isn't it true? Now I'm sold on the fact that there's a difference between spirituality and religion. Now, most religions say, and they point out, that God has left us alone to find out what true human spirituality is. All religions, in fact, they say God stepped in and told us how to have good relations with ourselves, how to have good relations with other people, and it varies slightly from each religion as to how God has done this. AA doesn't say anything like that. AA says it's not comfortable to say anything like that. Furthermore, every religion points out that human spirituality universally is flawed. Nobody, no human being is able to live positive, with positive attitude to themselves, to other people, and to God. It's all flawed. And people have sought for an explanation of this. Religion has done, and philosophies have done. And if you think it, I've dealt with it more fully here. I won't go into it in detail. But basically, they say it's due to ignorance or a
honesty or sin. And education is what we need to have good psychic life. Or there's something wrong with our environment. We're a dysfunctional family, or something wrong, and we need a better social environment if we have a positive psychic. And others say, some religions say, it's sin. It's sin. AA and NA, to my understanding, doesn't say what causes this dysfunction, what causes this psychic illness, this spiritual illness. They just say you've got it. You don't know where it comes from. They say we're not competent to say. And the way it's been put, the old expression that I was told, is that AA and NA say we're not wasting our time finding out how the jackass got into the ditch. The jackass is already in the ditch. We're only concerned with getting it out. And I used to have more books than the average group, reading this, that, and the other. And now I leave. Reading this, that, and the other. And now I leave the disease concept to the competent people, people like Dr. Barbara Ann, who explained to you, it's not my job, business in that. And I don't read about medical research. The doctors will tell me.
I'm sick in my body. My body doesn't know how to handle chemicals, mood-altering chemicals. And my brain does a most peculiar thing, which it doesn't do with my diabetes. My brain seems to have its wires crossed. It gives two contradictory messages to my body with regard to mood-altering chemicals. It says with alcohol and other drugs, it passes a message to my heart, to my liver, to my all my system, and says, we can't handle this. We can't process this. And at the same time, the brain says, but suck it to me, I want it. And that's addiction. That leads to insanity and death. You see? Now, recovery means I must recover in my body. It doesn't mean my brain gets unscrambled and I can now drink or take. No, it doesn't mean that. That would be cured. But I am healed of the temporary damage I've done to myself. I can't be healed of the permanent damage. I'm healed of the temporary damage. What is my sickness with regard to my attitude to myself? Let me just remind you of these. What is this negative, sick human spirituality? With regard to myself, is that I want to be completely independent of everybody. I don't want to acknowledge that I owe anybody anything. And I have an irrational conviction that I am the center of the universe. Some people think they're the king of the universe. Some people think they're the queen of the universe. I didn't stop there. I was God. My kingdom come, my will be done. And it's been a great relief a few years ago to resign from being God. Some of the therapists in Castle Craig tells me that I sometimes forget that I've resigned from being God. And so, in my sickness, my self-will is paramount. I want what I want when I want it. That's the sick young brother side of me. He wants what he wants when he wants it. You see, that's the sick. What is recovery then? Recovery is I accept myself as I am. I accept that I've got talents, gifts, and virtues, and I've also got faults and failings, right? That's recovery. That's ongoing recovery. That's spiritual recovery. What about other people? My sickness says other people only exist for me. They only exist to satisfy my needs. You see? That's what the baby thinks, and I haven't outgrown that, you see, in my sickness. Other people only exist for me. I don't let them be themselves. That's why they have that old saying, alcoholics and addicts, we don't get married, we take hostages. You see? And it's true. We don't make good friends because we're self-absorbed and self-centered. And so what does the recovering be with regard to other people? It's letting people be themselves. Let go. Let people be themselves. It's being able to forgive people. It's not carrying a resentment and so on and so forth, right? And then what is my attitude with regard to, what is a sick attitude with regard to God? Well, God only exists to serve my needs. God is the ever-open Social Security office. See? And if God does something that I don't agree with or approve of in the world or with me, how dare God do this without my permission? See, that's the sick. Whereas the recovery is, I've gradually learned to accept the second tradition of our fellowships, that God is a loving God, the supreme authority of a loving God. And I'll come on to that in a moment, of what that means to me in practice. So it's a multi-story illness, and so it has to be a multi-story recovery. That's my quarrel with, in Britain anyway, with the Council for Alcoholism. They mean well, but I think they have confused abuse of alcohol with addiction to alcohol. If I'm abusing alcohol and drinking very heavily and I'm simply an abuser, to my mind I can stop with a struggle, but I can stop. If I'm addicted, I can't stop without help. And I think they're confusing that myself. I think they're confusing that. You see, they say controlled drinking. And it's curious, they only do it with alcohol. I've never heard any group council say, let's have some controlled heroin using. Why don't you have social coke-sniffing parties? They don't do that. It's just alcohol they're hung up on. I think they really need treatment about that, to be frank. They're hung up about alcohol, you see. And I believe they're confusing. They're confusing the two. The sickness that I have, the addictive illness, has... It's not just alcohol. I'm not addicted to alcohol. I'm an addicted person. And that's why we have to be careful. I have to be careful of cross-addiction. I've got a list, which I found somewhere, of 21 different things and activities that I'm inclined to go for. You see? I mean, there's alcohol, there's other drugs. I won't say which are the other ones I'm inclined to go for. Alcohol was the one, because it was there. If heroin had been respectable for priests, I probably would have taken that. Well, of course. Of course. And we're certainly going to get priests ordained who had problems with other drugs. Of course we are. You see? I won't go into this. You know, one of them is forever getting university degrees. That's an addiction. A person hates themselves so much that if they have a whole alphabet of letters after their name, somebody might like them and somebody admire them. It's addiction. There's gambling, there's overeating, there's sex. I won't tell you which one I'm inclined towards, but there can be a whole lot. You see? So I have to recover mentally, I have to recover emotionally. Now, what does that mean? Well, emotionally, it means I don't have different feelings from other people. I have them in a different intensity. You see? I don't have anger. Anger has me. I don't have fear. I have panic. I don't have anger. Actually, I have rage. You see? And furthermore, I had these feelings before ever I took a drink or a drug. Like you, many of you, when I first went to AA meetings, I heard people say things like this: as long as I can remember, I don't feel I've ever fitted in. And I thought, how do they know my secret? As long as I can remember, I've been frightened, and I don't know what I'm frightened of. And I thought, that's me. As long as I can remember, I've been angry, and I'm not sure why I'm angry. And I thought, that's me. And you see, the trouble is, there you are in the school playground, and a teacher says, hello, what's the matter? You don't say, I'm frightened. What are you frightened? I don't know. You don't say that. They'll take you away. So what I learned to do was, I'm fine. You see? I come from a big, caring family. You see, six boys and a girl, all very close. We still are. And if I said to my mum, Mum, I don't think I fit in, she'd give me a thick ear. You see? What do you mean you don't fit in? You see? But I didn't feel like it. But I didn't reflect on that. That's just the way I know I felt. You see? And then I met alcohol and I did fit in. You see? And I met alcohol and I wasn't afraid anymore. And I met alcohol and I came out fighting, angry. You see? And they told me when I was in recovery, in treatment, that they said, you've got an underground reservoir of anger, and it'll take you, your recovery will be mainly how you deal with anger. I was very angry when they told me, but they're quite right, they're quite right. And you know, when I was 18 or 19, a normal, healthy young man, preparing to be a celibate priest, I went to an old priest and said, Father, does there come a time when we don't feel sexual impulses and desires? And he was quiet for a bit. Then he said, yes. He said, I think it's about half an hour after they put the lid on your coffin. You see? Well, with me, whatever about that, with me, the undertaker better be very careful how he treats me. So what is happening to us? What is happening to us in our recovery? What is this spiritual thing? We're called, the 12 steps says it's an awakening, a spiritual awakening. You see? Now, we must make see there's a difference. I've had to see there's a difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. A spiritual experience is something that happens to you. You've got no say in the matter. You have no preparation for it. It's out of the blue. It happens to you suddenly. You don't cause it. You don't bring it about. You can't guarantee it. Bill Wilson, for example, had a spiritual experience. He describes it in page 14 of the big book, right, where he felt this clean, purifying wind, and it was the mainspring of his sobriety. You see? And other people have had this. Other people have seen things or others in some kind of vision. They've heard voices speaking to them, or they've had some uncanny experience. You see? And it can happen to people who don't regard themselves as particularly spiritual, let alone religious, and it can happen anywhere. I've heard people, men tell me they've had a spiritual experience while in prison. And it looks like a coincidence a lot of the time, but the person knows it isn't. I'll give you one example that sticks in my mind, which happened actually to a patient in Castle Craig Clinic, where I work. He was a young chap, he was only 18, and he'd been on heroin since, and his name was Peter. His name is Peter. And he told me afterwards that he just felt trapped. He was trapped in shame and guilt like I was. He just felt trapped. And what was the point? You know, he wouldn't recover. What was the point? He felt trapped, young Peter. And he was saying this to two other patients. And there's a little chapel in Castle Craig. And they said, why don't we go down to the chapel? And he rather reluctantly went down. And they said, well, we'll pray. And he said, I don't want to pray. They said, well, we'll pray. And they went down. And he doesn't know why he did this. He went forward and to the podium and picked up a Bible. But he dropped it. And the Bible fell open. So he picked it up and he looked. And it was the 12th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, where Peter is in prison by Herod. And an angel of God is sent and leads him out of prison, out into freedom. And this is what Peter read. Now he said, that changed his whole attitude. This was him, a spiritual experience. Somebody else would say it was a coincidence. But he says, no, it wasn't. I've never been so affected in my life, you see. Now, it's a rare thing, a spiritual experience. And people would say, well, it doesn't happen. I assure you it does. Anyone who says it doesn't happen, there are more things in heaven and earth than our philosophies. And anyone who says it doesn't, to me, they've got a closed mind. But I've never had one. I've never had a spiritual experience. Anything that I could describe as that. And if we had to wait till we got a spiritual experience before we found recovery, then very few of us, I think, would recover. You see? But the 12th step says you're going to have a spiritual awakening if you practice the other 11 steps. You'll have a spiritual awakening. And to me, that is a very apt description of what happens to us. We're like people who've been asleep. We have been asleep. We've been unconscious. We've been unconscious of who we really are. At least I have been. And we get lost in dreams and nightmares. And we start waking up to who I really am. You see? The first step, I wake up to the fact I'm powerless and my life's unmanageable. And the fourth step, my inventory, my fifth step, I wake up to who I am. You see? I wake up to who other people are. I wake up to the people I've got to make amends to. I wake up to the people I haven't been loving as I should. And I wake up to everybody. You see, I'll be talking to everybody. I can't allow prejudice or anything like that. Incidentally, at the clinic where I work, we do get patients who are from extreme Calvinist church, or they're members of the Orange Lodge. And when they see me, they don't want to come near me. Right. They're not going to come listen to a Catholic priest. And they're told they have to. They have to come to my lectures at least. And I always say to them, look, we're sick people trying to recover. And we haven't got time for prejudice. We can leave that to the so-called normal people out there. Let them go and kill each other. But we can't do this. I say, I promise I won't make you an Orangeman or a wee free if you don't. I won't make you a Catholic if you don't make me an Orangeman or a wee free, okay? And it works. We become friends, you see. We've no time for prejudice, you see. Our spiritual awakening is we see people. We don't see labels. And then we wake up, as I've said, to who God really is. And if I can't say God, I can say higher power. I can say the fellowship. I can say Jimmy. I can say Gladys. I can say what I like. God doesn't mind. You see? God doesn't mind. You see? But it's loving. And I wake up to that. You see? And that's how we start living our spiritual recovery, by this waking up. And it's going on all the time. But look what happens to other people through us. Because the 12th step goes on to say that we must carry the message to others, to fellow sufferers. And you and I, we don't reach out to fellow sufferers with pity, or with mercy, or even with charity. We reach out with compassion. And if you look that up at a dictionary, that word, compassion, its root is from two Latin words, cum patior, to suffer with, to endure with. Because we've known what it's like to be ashamed and guilty, we can understand the shame and guilt in other people. Because we know what it's like to be so possessed by fear and anger, we can understand the fear and anger in somebody else. Because we know what it's like, that terrible loneliness of our addiction, and the terrible loneliness of those who love us in Al-Anon and L-Teen and so on. We know what it's like to be alone, you see? And we can understand and feel for somebody else. And that's compassion. And other people can't do that for them. They can give them pity, they can give them mercy, they can give them help, but we can give them compassion because we've endured with them, or we are enduring with them, you see? Now, it doesn't mean, there's several things I've learned in my recovery that I will never say. I don't ever say, I don't think, I'm sure, I don't ever say to another person, I know how you feel. Because I don't know how they feel. Everybody's unique. What I do say, especially to new patients, if you're as frightened as I was, then I have an idea how frightened you are. If you're as angry as I've been, I have an idea how angry you are, you see? But I don't say I know how you feel. Another thing we don't say, do we, in our recovery, isn't it wonderful in AA and NA, and we don't say, don't cry. It's instinctive to say, don't cry to people, you see? And we have, in Northern Europe, and especially in English-speaking countries, we have a particular form of cruelty to children. We tell boys that they mustn't cry. And because boys aren't allowed to cry, men get ulcers and heart attacks. You see? But Italian boys cry, Arab boys cry, Russian boys cry. Why the heck shouldn't Irish boys or Dutch boys cry or English boys cry? You see? We don't say that to each other. In AA and NA, men are allowed to cry. You see? That's wonderful. Another thing I've learned, I never say to people, either in the fellowship or in the clinic or when I'm preaching, I never say, you should or you should not, and you must not. I always say, I've learned to say, don't get me wrong, if I were you, this is what I would do. Or this is what I did. Or I suggest. And it gives the person the freedom. To me, only God is allowed to say, you must and you must not, and you should. Only God can give us commandments. I have no right to give anybody a commandment. That I can repeat God's commandments, but I have no right to say so, you see. So we give compassion. And isn't that what the world needs? Because the longer I've been a priest and the longer I've been in recovery, I have come to realize that everybody in the world is hurt in some way. And the people who look as though they're coping, they're just the walking wounded. And I believe the whole human family is a hospital. And we have no doctors and no nurses. All the patients are meant to nurse and doctor each other. We're meant to have compassion. When I was a younger man, I was very, very keen on justice. I was forever shouting justice. And then one day it struck me, if I get justice, I'll get what I deserve. So I'm really sold on mercy. And in fact, I've gone further. I think what the world needs is compassion. Because we hear, you can't have peace unless you have justice. But just suppose you had compassion. Suppose the Arabs and the Jews had compassion. Suppose they had compassion for each other in the north. Suppose they had compassion in the Balkans, in Kosovo. There'd be no ethnic cleansing, no genocide. There'd be no landmines, no cluster bombs, no children with their limbs blown off. There'd be no refugees. It would almost empty our prisons. That's it. No one would be ashamed of having AIDS or venereal disease. No one. But the world needs us compassion. And look what we're able to do. In our own circle, we're able to do that. You see? And it seems to me that this is surely part of the reason why God has given me this illness and given many of you this illness. And why he's given me this recovery. We've been chosen to be wounded healers. Wounded healers. That's it. The thing I was most ashamed of is the thing that enables me to reach out to others. You see? And I better be, watch the time. I heard the most marvelous description of what it means to live a spiritual recovery. You see? When I went to AA after treatment, I was envious of people in who seemed to me to have something I didn't have. They had their act together. I know now they had a certain level of serenity and I didn't. And I used to ask them, what do you do when you're not at meetings? How do you do each day? How do you cope with anger? How do you cope with fear? And between all of them, they all in more or less said to me that they actually took as the most important of all their steps the daily living of the third step. That they've made a decision, and now they've got to carry it out, and they hand their will and their life over to the care of God as they understand God, over to the care of the higher power. And notice, it's not about doing God's will. The third step doesn't say God's will. It's the 11th step that says that. The third step says care. I acknowledge God's care of me. And they live this, you see. And that enables them to take all the other steps. So that when I come to do my fourth step, I'm in God's care when I do it. When I make the admission of my fifth step, I do it in God's care, you see? And look what this God is like. How many people have said to me, and how many people say to you, it's time you pulled yourself together, it's time you stop losing your temper, it's time you stop... God doesn't do that. The sixth step says, we became entirely ready for God to remove our defects. And God waits till I'm ready. And I say, I'm not ready to give up my temper yet. Okay, we'll wait. We'll wait. Till you're entirely ready, then you can ask me humbly. All right? You see? St. Augustine was a womanizer. He treated women very badly before his conversion, of course. And he said he used to pray, please God make me pure, but not just yet. You see? And that can be something of my prayers. I'm not ready to give up things, and God waits. You see? But I know I'm in God's care. Even when I'm not ready to give something up, I'm in God's care. I'm in God's care when I'm making the list of people to make amends to and when I'm trying to make amends. You see? We're already in God's care. And as I say, I'll finish with this. There was in Edinburgh being a tourist city, one of the main meeting places there, Coburn Street, we got a lot of visitors from AA from all over the world. And this was an American visitor who was asked to do the main chair at the top table. And I don't think anyone who ever heard him will forget the way he shared. And it was really, he encapsulated what we mean by living a spiritual recovery, what our spiritual awakening is. He said, he gave us his name, and then he said, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous the day after the police took me off an express train which was going from Washington to Chicago because I was so drunk I couldn't stand up. And he said, you may wonder, why were the police called to take me legless drunk off this express train? He said, well, you see, I was driving the train. Then he went on to take the train as an illustration of his life, and he suggested our lives. He said, what kind of a person has been driving your train? And he said, it wasn't the demon or the devil, it's you, the sick young brother side of me, or the sick young sister side, you see. He said, your train has been hijacked. I see. This sick person is driving it, and the healthy you is bound and gagged. He said, have you always been on the right track? Have you ever been off the lines? He went on. Have you slowed down for amber warning lights? Have you stopped for red lights? And what about the passengers on your train? What kind of a ride have they been having, you see? And lately, he said, there have been people at wayside stations trying to get on to help you, and you've just roared past. And he went on and on and on, you see? So he said, what do we need in our hijacked train? He said, we need a new driver. And we need a driver who is stronger than the sick me and also stronger than the healthy me. He must be stronger than both. He must know more about the track, more about the lines, more about the train, and he must be stronger than the sick me to take that way, and he must be stronger than the healthy me because the train will be hijacked again. And he said, what happens when you're released, the healthy you? You don't go back and become a passenger. He said, you drive the train, but you've got a senior driver. And you must always check with your senior driver. Is this the way to do it? Is this what you want me to do? Is this the way I should be behaving? You see? Now, I have found that very, very helpful. That to me is what AA and NA means by a spiritual recovery. I recover in my relationships with myself, with others. And so I don't get happiness. Happiness to me is a passing thing. It means I have contentment. I'm content to be who I am for the first time in my life. I'm content to be where I am for the first time in my life. I'm not in competition anymore with anyone, and least of all with my sick self, and not with God either, you see. And so it means that we're gradually set free from being held captive by our addiction. We walk into freedom, and we have peace. We have peace, and those who love us have peace. And that's what I understand by our marvelous spiritual recovery. Thank you.